Thing in Fukushima is fine. It's safe. No problem. Y'all come down for the 2020 Olympics. But then, when you hear one of our most important nuclear experts and researchers report,
one of the NRC emails said all of northern Japan is an RCA. And the press completely missed the significance of that terrifying email. In nuke speak, RCA means radiologically contaminated area. And here, 3 days after Fukushima Daiichi, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission knew that all of northern Japan was a radiologically contaminated area. That's a secret that's been kept from the Japanese people.
Well, when you hear something like that from Arne Gunderson, a source you know you can trust, you immediately understand the twisted nature of reality created by nuclear interest not only in Japan, but all over, and start to feel that extremely heated seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we hear Arne Gunderson, chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, speak on the impact that the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster has had on the people who have to live with it. From doctors trying to provide an accurate diagnosis for their patients' radiation-related diseases to the soaring divorce rate in Fukushima marriages. Personal stories, personally gathered by Arne, with powerful international impact. Plus, we will, of course, have Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness and more honest nuclear information than was visible in all of last Saturday's international women's marches combined. All of this coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 23rd, 2018, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We'll just go for it.
Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Numbnuts of the week.
In the wake of Hawaii's terrifying false alarm on January 13, where the state citizens spent 38 minutes convinced that North Korea was about to land a nuclear weapon on them any second, there have been a lot of tales of hackers, false flags, Trojan horses, and conspiracy theories floated to explain how this happened. After careful examination of all the facts that I can identify as facts, I believe it was something far more terrifying. Gross government incompetence, bad management, lackadaisical attitudes, and antiquated computer pull-down menus. And the ultimate numbnuts in all of this? An Associated Press photo from last July recently surfaced on Twitter. It shows the Hawaiian Emergency Management Agency's operations officer proudly posing in front of computer screens, one of which has a post-it on it that is clearly labeled password with the visible password underneath. So if this was a conspiracy, it was a long-standing one to keep the gross negligence, incompetence, and stupidity of that agency hidden from any kind of authority. Busted! And that's why, HIEMA, Hawaiian Emergency Management Agency, you
are so this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Two stories that may or may not be related to our Num Nuts. Japanese broadcaster NHK, the equivalent of PBS, issued a false alarm on Tuesday, January 16, saying North Korea appeared to have launched a missile and urging people to take shelter. I didn't know it was rerun season. They rescinded the message within minutes. And on Friday, January 19, the warning sirens went off at the Shearson-Hammel nuclear facility in North Carolina, only 24 miles from Raleigh. Again, it was an accidental activation. Copycats? At the Hanford site in Washington State, 100 workers are being moved out of the trailer village of offices near the nuclear reservation's plutonium finishing plant because, as the workers were told in a memo, the recent problems with contamination were being caused by, quote, overwhelming presence of naturally occurring radon, end quote. Oh, just say swamp gas and be done with it. The spread of radioactive contamination was found after workers finished demolishing most of the plant's plutonium reclamation facility in mid-December. Hint, hint. To date, 21 government or government contractor vehicles had possible contamination detected, and 7 personal vehicles with exterior contamination were also found. As of Wednesday, 271 workers had requested checks for possible inhalation or ingestion of radioactive particles from the contamination spread. Not from radon. The Los Alamos National Laboratory has been fined $3.1 million for shipping plutonium via commercial air. The National Nuclear Security Administration cited the shipping foul-up and other environmental health and safety lapses as indicating a programmatic breakdown in safety management at the lab. They should have gone UPS ground instead of FedEx air. It would have been cheaper and legal. And isn't that a scary thought? Catching up with news in Japan, a ruling by Hiroshima's High Court halting the planned restart of a nuclear reactor in Ehime Prefecture has cast doubt on the judgment of Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority, which had approved the restart under stricter post-Fukushima guidelines, shocking the government and utilities across the nation. The ruling deals a heavy blow to a plan by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's administration to bring more reactors back online and is sure to prompt the government and utilities to keep a closer eye on similar cases continuing across the country. A group advised by 2 former Japanese prime ministers unveiled the outline of a bill calling for an immediate shutdown of the country's nuclear power stations in favor of natural energy resources. Former Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi told a press conference, moving Japan away from nuclear power is difficult under the Shinzo Abe administration. But that goal will absolutely be realized in the near future with the support from a majority of citizens. In the Netherlands, the largest Dutch pension fund, the Civil Service Fund ABP, has decided to end its investments in producers of nuclear weapons, a big win for Don't Bank on the Bomb. And in Ukraine, Chernobyl is being transformed into an immense renewable energy farm, with 3,800 solar panels already installed to support a 1 megawatt solar power plant. Who'd have thunk it? We'll have this week's feature in just a moment, but first, if you value honest, verifiable information on nuclear issues, with context and continuity on the stories that you care about, then you have come to value Nuclear Hot Seat. We do our best each and every week to get behind the scenes, under the skin, and into the heart of nuclear matters, with fresh information you won't find in mainstream media. I am grateful for the support that you, the listeners, give to Nuclear Hot Seat throughout the years. And without your generosity, this show would not be able to continue. So if you're grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, show your support by sending us a donation to help us meet our expenses, be it a one-time donation or a monthly sustaining donation. It all helps keep the information flowing out to you. the listeners. And we make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That works for a one-time or a continuing donation of any size. And for an easy and inexpensive way to help us out, you can send the show a monthly $5, the equivalent of a cup of coffee and a nice tip to the barista. Do that by going to the website and clicking on the big green donate button. Do what you can to help Nuclear Hot Seat keep searching and sharing nuclear information so that you can understand what's really going on. Know that whatever you can afford, you're helping to combat the nuclear menace in all its forms. That makes me deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's feature. Arne Gundersen is the chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, and he is one of the most consistent and insightful researchers and commentators on the nuclear disaster at Fukushima. This week, we share a presentation he made on December 2, 2017, at DePaul University in Chicago. Fukushima, Where Are the People? This talk took place after the highly subsidized full day of nuke speak put on by the University of Chicago, celebrating their involvement in the first atomic pile on its 75th anniversary. They even exploded fireworks to celebrate it. Through Arne and his experiences during four separate trips to Fukushima, we get a different nuclear picture than what's put out by the nuclear so-called experts. This countering event at DePaul University was sponsored by Chicago's Nuclear Energy Information Service, or NEIS, and they presented Arne along with other speakers that we will feature in future nuclear hot seats. I was honored to be able to attend. One note, Arne makes references to several slides, but from his descriptions, you should have no problem following what he's talking about.
I was going to school as a nuclear engineer when the Fukushima Daiichi reactors were being built. That was in the late 60s. But more importantly for Chicago, I was going to school when the Dresden reactors were being built, which are only crow flight less than 50 miles away from where we are today. The reason I bring Dresden up is that the two reactors at Dresden are identical to the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi. Keep that in mind as I talk about readings I've taken in Tokyo over the years, which is about 130 miles away from Daiichi, compared to 50 miles for the reactor at Dresden. For the academics in the room, I was a Atomic Energy Commission fellow for my graduate degree, and now I'm a research fellow at the University of Vermont, in addition to being the chief engineer at Fairwinds. And recently I had published a peer review report on the particle size of radiation in Japan. I'll get into that in a slide later, but I think it's important that there's a peer review journal out there. And Dave did not mention it, but while I was a senior vice president in the nuclear industry, I am also a nuclear whistleblower. And I've experienced the congressional hearings with John Glenn and a dramatic life change that might entail. I think you can imagine that. Well, where are the people? In 2011, we're almost 7 years into it now, people were forced to evacuate their communities, their cities, their ancestral homeland because of the triple meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. And the question really should be, as Dave said in the introductory remarks, where are they now? Who watches out for them now? Who speaks for them now and who speaks to them now? Who helps them build new lives and move on from this event? And I think my conclusion is that no one does. I've been to Fukushima Prefecture four times in the last 6 years. And when you, Fukushima Prefecture, the term prefecture is essentially a state in the United States. They're essentially synonymous. And while Japan is sort of far away, you know, geographically, it's almost on the other side of the Northern Hemisphere. But in fact, the people there lived lives very similar to ours. So when I talk about the people, I think the nuclear industry has done an excellent job of removing us from them, when in fact they're as close as the person sitting next to us. Their kids play little leagues. They go to school. They coach soccer. They have jobs in the cities and jobs on the farms, and they grow their food organically. And until the disaster just totally disrupted their lives, their experience, their life experience, and our life experience are essentially identical. So this particular slide, and I have this one and one other I will be a geek during, but the rest of this is geek-free material. This particular slide is something from a photograph from a scanning electron microscope, and it's of a radioactive particle we discovered in vacuum cleaner dust. It's highly radioactive. It's essentially a piece of nuclear fuel. And we found it in Nagoya, which is about 300 crow flight miles from Fukushima Daiichi, in vacuum cleaner dust. As I was struggling with trying to put a bow around this presentation, just this week, Japan Today had a headline, and it said, "Risky Stalemate as Science Battles Human Fears at Fukushima." And I think that really encapsulates what I wanted to talk about today. The nuclear industry has, and the Japanese government, have co-opted the media. And what we've got here is a typical example in that one headline. It's as if science knows what's right, and then we have this irrational human fear that people just don't understand. You know, if they really knew the science, they would come back to their homes and play baseball on the fields and have a good time in life. Well, I'm a scientist, and I've been all my life, and I'm afraid. And when I saw this headline, I just said, shame on Japan Today for publishing a headline like that. Really, the topic of today is using the internet to speak truth to power. And that's what we at Fairwinds have been doing since the disaster. And by power, we mean the worldwide nuclear industry, the national nuclear industries, and banks and politicians as well. When we speak truth to power, it's a group of citizens using the internet effectively to butt heads against the powers that be. And this is something that didn't exist with Chernobyl and didn't exist with Three Mile Island. And what makes this point in history unique is that the internet has allowed us to transmit information faster and more accurately than we ever could have done back 20 years ago. So speaking truth to power is something that my wife Maggie and I have been doing together and at Fairwinds for a couple decades now. We've been married for 39 years. And we met when we were both in the nuclear industry. So we were sort of a nuclear family. and Maggie is the strategic thinker here, and I'm sort of just the talking head. But for me, this is really about giving people a voice in the international conversation about nuclear power. And on the opposite side of the argument are governments, the nuclear industry, and unfortunately, a co-opted media. So as I said, I've been to Japan four times, totaling 2 months of my life in the last 4 years. And I wanted to share my observations, and I promise there's only one geeky slide. But rather than spend a lot of time on rads and rems and becquerels and curies released and all that stuff, I really wanted to focus on the impact on the human beings that are involved. The first trip was in February of 2012. It was for a week. The second trip was in September of 2012, and it was for 10 days. And then in 2016, I was there for an entire month. And I just came back from another trip that ended in September, which was for 2 weeks. Of gathering data and teaching scientists and citizens there how to collect data on their own. The key to this is crowdsourcing, another one of those inventions of the 21st century that didn't exist before. The first trip I'll get into was was sponsored. But the last three trips that I took over there were crowdsourced. And I'm sure you all know what that means, but citizens in Japan and in the United States sponsored my travel and my lodging, and I, of course, donated my time. But, you know, there's some legitimate out-of-pocket costs that crowdsourcing has allowed us to do. Speaking truth to power in crowdsourcing sort of reminds me of that comment that when the Air Force needs a new bomber, they raise your taxes. When the library needs new books, they hold a bake sale. And really, crowdsourcing is the 21st century's equivalent to the bake sale. Before I get into my trip, so I want to talk about the background of the institutions in Japan that we were facing when we went over there. The first is Prime Minister Abe had passed a law called the State Secrets Act, and it can be interpreted as allowing the government to imprison journalists, teachers, scientists, and others when they discuss Fukushima in a light that's unflattering to the government. It's a very loosely written law that terrifies journalists and other people. In fact, when I was over there recently, they urged me to get my samples done before I started my public speaking because they were afraid I might get thrown out of the country. During the same time I was over there, 6 months after the nuclear disaster, Prime Minister Abe declared that Fukushima was in something called cold shutdown. Now, in nuke speak, the jargon that I grew up with, that means that the plant is cool and you can begin to refuel it. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It's sort of like George Bush's comment about mission accomplished. And, you know, 15 years later, we're still involved. The other piece of the puzzle is the relationship between the regulator and the government and the banks and Tokyo Electric. And sort of those four pieces of the puzzle. I'll be using TEPCO frequently, but it stands for Tokyo Electric. And it was the largest nuclear utility and one of the largest utilities in the world. It turns out that 3 weeks after the disaster, the government, its regulators, the equivalent of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and TEPCO and their banks, cut a deal. And the deal basically assured that TEPCO would survive. So while they should have been focused on the survival of its citizens, they basically said their top priority was the survival of Tokyo Electric. In addition, about a year after that, The Japanese government successfully lobbied to get the Tokyo Olympics into Japan. It's the Summer Olympics in 2020. This is really a blatant attempt to replace a public fear of radiation contaminating northern Japan with a feel-good event like the Olympics. That's what's happening in Japan even today. And the last piece of this background that I went into was the censoring of doctors. I didn't realize it when I went over, but I've spoken to many doctors, and they're all under enormous pressure. When they see situations with people that clearly have a radiation-related illness, they're not allowed to diagnose it as such. They have to say it's stress. Now, what this is doing is several-fold. It's putting the burden of the illness back on the person who is in fact really ill. And it's also destroying the epidemiological record for scientists like me. So years from now, when we start to go back and look at what somebody may have died from or how they got their illness, we're going to go back into records that show stress-related illnesses as opposed to the real cause of those illnesses. That's the background against which my trips have been made. The first trip was sponsored by Shueisha. Maggie and I co-authored a book with a Japanese author. In English, the title is Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Way Forward. It talks about the cause of the accident, but it also shows the Japanese an alternative approach to the future. And Shueisha was our publisher. They sponsored the first trip. Well, I was there for a week, the very first day, I spoke at the National Press Club. And at the National Press Club, I was the first person to talk about the cost of decontaminating not just the nuclear site, like it's happening at Zion, but in fact the whole state of Fukushima. The state of Fukushima is roughly the size of Connecticut. It's a big hunk of real estate. And at the time, Tokyo Electric was downplaying the cost of the decommissioning and the cleanup of the prefecture, saying it would be perhaps $10 billion. And I was the first one to say that the cost was in fact going to be $250 billion, or $250 billion. Now, finally, 6 months, 6 years later, many think tanks in Japan have reached the same conclusion. But at the time, the Japanese government didn't want people to realize the impact of the disaster. I think it's a death by a thousand cuts, where if you don't tell them and then you just increase it by another $5 billion and another $5 billion, it kind of sneaks up on you. But we put it out there at Fairwinds that this is a quarter to a half a trillion dollar problem to clean up that prefecture. In the first trip, I collected five radioactive samples. This sample was from the roof of the publisher. I collected another sample at a children's playground, another at a Buddhist temple, another at a crack in the sidewalk. These are all in Tokyo, 140 miles away from the disaster. When I got back, I came into the country with five small bags of dirt, and I declared that through customs, and I explained that I had collected dirt. And then I sent it to a laboratory. And what surprised me is the answer that I got back. What the lab told us was that the dirt we collected was so radioactive that if it were in America, it would have to be classified as radioactive waste. Now, Fairwinds published that, and the Associated Press then also published it. And I think the next thing that happened is illustrative. The NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute, questioned me and the reporter and actually tried to get the reporter fired. So to AP's credit, they stood behind me for the science and the reporter for the reporting. But the pressure to publish something that goes against the orthodoxy, if you will, even with good science, is astronomical. The other thing I learned after that, so now I had collected five samples, and I said, wow, Tokyo is quite contaminated. So then after that, through a Freedom of Information Act, there was an NRC release of emails. One of the NRC emails said all of northern Japan is an RCA. And the press completely missed the significance of that terrifying email. In Nukespeak, RCA means radiologically contaminated area. And what that means is there's some places in a nuclear plant where you can walk in civilian clothes. But there's other places that are so contaminated you can't walk in civilian clothes, that you have to put booties on and gloves and overalls. Those are called RCAs. And here, 3 days after Fukushima Daiichi, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission knew that all of northern Japan was a radiologically contaminated area. But yet you don't see people walking around in booties and gloves and throughout all of northern Japan. That's a secret that's been kept from the Japanese people. My second trip was a university tour, and this one and all the others were indeed crowdsourced. I was there for 10 days, spoke at the University of Tokyo, and also at the Diet. The Diet is Japan's parliament. When I was at the Diet, my presentation revolved around nuclear fuel pool fires. And I had a study from a national lab where they actually heated a piece of nuclear fuel electrically and proved that indeed nuclear fuel can catch fire in a fuel pool. So I showed this picture and many others of the nuclear fuel burning in air. Well, after my presentation, TEPCO came up and made their presentation. And they said there's no risk of fire in the fuel pool because there's nothing in the fuel pool to burn. Now, the Japanese audiences are normally very attentive, but there's not a lot of emotional feedback from the group to the speaker. And I have gotten used to that. But when Tokyo Electric said there's nothing in the fuel pool to burn, 500 people started to scream. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. And my interpreter is talking in my ear and telling me what's going on. But it's an example of the absolute lack of trust that the Japanese people have in both their government and in the integrity of Tokyo Electric. The other thing I saw when I was there was how citizens were surrounding the Prime Minister's house. Every Friday at around 4 o'clock until about 8 o'clock, hundreds of thousands of people would materialize out of the subway and surround the Prime Minister's house, beating drums, making enormous noise, and there were also speakers there to talk to the crowd about the problem. And this went on for months. And I think that's another example of the lack of trust that the Japanese population has in their own government and in the integrity of their prime minister. And the most touching thing that happened to me on my second trip was when I was in Niigata. Niigata is on the west side of Japan. Fukushima is on the east side. And I met a woman who wanted to thank me for the work that Fairwinds did, and she spoke excellent English. And she explained to me that she had left Fukushima Prefecture with her two kids and was reestablishing a life in Niigata. And her husband had told her that if she didn't return, he was going to get a divorce. This is something that's quite commonly called the Fukushima divorce now. Well, she told me with tears in her eyes that she said, okay, I am not coming back. I'm not taking the kids back. So you'll have to divorce me. But before you do, I want you to do one thing. And he said, sure, what is it? And she said, I want you to watch the Fairwind site. And he did, and he moved to Niigata to be with her. So I guess I could be a certified marriage counselor here. Which was really touching personally. But besides that, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but it talks about the power of the internet to speak truth to power. You know, we have a small little nonprofit. And we are making enormous influence in a country that's half a world away. The third trip was a long one. It was a month, and it involved about 60 speeches and days of sample collection in Japan. On our website, the Fairwinds website, there's a Japan tour speaking series. And what I would do is I'd call Maggie via Skype, and she would record it. And there's about five of my recollections of things that I experienced there. A couple of the things I experienced were the amazing quantity of bags of radioactive waste. Now, each one of those black bags is a meter, about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, and it weighs a ton. And I saw about a couple hundred thousand bags of waste scattered throughout the entire prefecture, including in people's backyards, and they were still in their homes. In fact, there's 30 million bags of waste throughout the prefecture. Think about that. That's 30 million tons of waste throughout the prefecture. And that only includes cleanup of 5% of the prefecture. They can't clean the mountains. What they're doing is they're cleaning the streets, they're cleaning next to the streets, they're cleaning the buildings, but they're not cleaning the surroundings. That's an important thing for a little bit later. This is me in a car with the windows closed. And although you can't see it in this picture, the radiation levels in that car are 15 times higher, with the windows closed, 15 times higher than they are in Burlington, Vermont, where I'm from. One of the most important scientific discoveries I made was on the roof of the Minamisoma Town Hall. Minamisoma was one of those communities that had been evacuated early, but the people were now told it was clean enough to come back into. The Minamisoma Town Hall had been completely decontaminated, and a nice fresh coat of green epoxy paint had been laid on the roof, Then on top of that had been placed solar collectors. Well, so that was 3 years after the disaster. They cleaned the roof and they put solar collectors on. And I was there 5 years after the disaster. I took samples. Guess what? There was highly radioactive dust on the roof, four stories high, of the Minami-Soma Town Hall that had been previously cleaned. Well, how can that be? Then, of course, what's happening is if you don't clean the whole prefecture, the dirt and dust from the surrounding mountains blows back in. So, and it's not just the roof of that school. What I found personally upsetting, upsetting is probably too light a word. It was heartfelt pain. I would see little girls riding down the street on their bicycles in the dirt on the side of the road, the dust on the side of the road, knowing that those tires were throwing up the same radioactive dirt that I had discovered on the roof of the Minami-Soma Town Hall. This one I put in to show the power of the internet. Three colleagues and I were taking radioactive samples at the Soma Family Temple, right on the outskirts of Minami-Soma. And we were walking around and talking, and the priest heard us and came down those stairs behind us. He walked by my three other colleagues. He walked right up to me, stuck his hand out, and said, "I know you. You're on YouTube." I'm not bragging, but think about the power of the internet. That's really the bottom line here, is that as citizens, we have something that the people in Chernobyl didn't have and the people of Three Mile Island didn't have, but it is a tool that we can use to speak truth to power. This is a displaced village. 160,000 people were evacuated their homes after the disaster, 160,000. And Japan set up these, I almost want to call them refugee camps, but they are villages for displaced people. And in this particular one, there were 60 or 70 families that came from the same town and had moved to this. The town was much bigger than 60 or 70, so some of their friends were in other villages, and they had been displaced to the far end of Fukushima Prefecture. I got to meet with the people in that community, and they all experienced symptoms of illness from radiation. They all experienced something that scientists don't know what causes, but there's a metallic taste in your mouth that they all experienced, and it seems to be somehow related to a physiological effect of inhaling radioactive material. Everyone experienced that. One woman had, she lost her hair. She had a bloody nose for 2 to 3 months. Her exposed skin had blotches on it. And when she went to the doctor, he said, "It's stress." Another woman was evacuated very quickly from her home when she heard the sirens go off. And she ran barefoot across the lawn and got in her car and drove to the evacuation center. She was so radioactive, she was not allowed in. Her feet turned black for 3 years, and her dog died 1 week afterward. Another man, who was a fisherman, he came back in. He was out fishing on the day of the disaster. And he came back in, and he said, he noticed what he said was a strange sunburn. He was sunburned through his clothes. And afterward, 2 or 3 days afterward, layers of his skin, he said 2 or 3 layers of his skin were sloughing off in sheets. That's a sign of the amount of radiation that was not measured because there weren't detectors working at the time, but to which the population was exposed. My hats are off to the women in these villages. When I met, that picture previously was one of the few that actually had men in it. Whenever I met with the villagers, it was the women who came forward and discussed the problems, and the men would not come out. And within Japan, there's a schism between the thoughts of the Japanese women and the thoughts of the Japanese men on nuclear power. The men trust the government and, don't worry, be happy. And the women are much more questioning and concerned about future generations. So I met on the third tour more of these women that were going through Fukushima divorces. This is a mother from Fukushima. And I'm about, this picture was taken about 200 miles south of the disaster area. She moved there with her kids, and her husband remains in Fukushima. The husband, after 5 years, sued her for divorce. And as part of the divorce, he wants the kids back. He wants the kids to go back into Fukushima Prefecture. That's bad. But what's worse is that her own parents are supporting the husband to get the kids to move back into Fukushima Prefecture. And their logic is the government says it's safe. So therefore, it's safe. And what's more of a concern to me is that the court system in Japan is supporting the husbands as well, because the government says it's safe. So the example I had in Niigata is, in fact, a rare one. In fact, it's much more likely that these Fukushima divorces end where the mother takes the kids back and lives in a contaminated environment in order to remain married to her husband. Dr. Mita is one of my personal heroes. I met him on this third trip as well. Dr. Mita ran a clinic in Fukushima Prefecture and diagnosed people with radiation illness. But the government refused to pay the bills unless he changed the diagnosis to stress. And Dr. Mita refused. And he closed his clinic and left the prefecture rather than change his diagnosis. And in the process, suffered a huge financial loss as well, because none of those patients that he saw was he ever compensated for. One of my personal heroes. For the first 5 years, I was collecting samples, and this all led to a peer-reviewed paper that Dr. Marco Kaltofen and I have published. Dr. Kaltofen is at Worcester Polytechnic in Massachusetts, and the journal is called Staten. It's called Science of the Total Environment. What we discovered, based on all this data that we've collected, is this. We have the largest database of dirt and dust samples in the world. We had about 200 samples of dirt from America and Canada, and about the same number of samples from dirt in Japan. Now, this is my geek moment here, so you got to bear with me. This is it. If you remember, the center line in a highway is called the median. Well, the median of data is you stack all the data out in a row, and from the lowest to the highest. And the median radiation in America is about 2 becquerels per kilogram. Just remember 2. In a kilogram of dirt, there's 2 disintegrations every second. That's the median in America, largely from bomb testing. So 2 is the number for America. In Japan, the median is 3,000. So it's 1,000 plus times higher than the median in America. Now, that's a concern enough, but the bigger concern is the rest of the data. The mean, which is just the average, is 9 times higher than the median. And 5% of the data is 10,000 times higher than the median. Now, what does that mean? It's my geek moment here. That means that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency's dose model, for the Japanese is wrong. That they're assuming sort of a uniform distribution of radiation in what's being inhaled or what's being imbibed. But what we discovered is it's not uniform. And there's a significant 5%+ of the particles that these people are inhaling are much larger than the IAEA allows. So the exposure to those individuals over 10 or 15 or 20 years. Because remember, these particles are so small, they don't leave your lungs. They don't leave your liver. They will cause a significant increase in cancers over the years that the IAEA and the Japanese government are refusing to acknowledge. The Staten paper, by the way, is in the top 3% of all of the academic journals that have been published in the last couple of years, as measured by a company that measures it called Altmetrics. So it's being well read, but we've got no feedback yet. Okay, trip number 4. This is the one that just ended a couple months ago. The woman, this is a miraculous group of people. The woman on the left with the red hair is a bomb survivor from Nagasaki. They call them hibakusha. So she is a Nagasaki hibakusha. The woman next to her is a mother of two children who became an expert in the incineration of waste to protect her community and to protect her children. The guy in the middle with the hat is a welder from Fukushima Daiichi who lost his house. The man in the front with the red shirt on is a farmer whose entire herd was radioactively contaminated. The tall guy in the back with the yellow shirt is a hibakusha from Hiroshima. So we've got a Nagasaki, Hiroshima, Fukushima. They should be the bookends on history in this picture. And of course, there's Dr. Kaltofen and me. And these were my traveling buddies for 2 weeks. Well, here's what we found. First off, wild boar are proliferating in the prefecture. It used to be that farmers would kill the wild boar and eat it, but now they're so radioactively contaminated they can't eat them. The government has developed an incinerator that can burn 600 wild boar a year, but they're proliferating faster than they can be destroyed. And there's no bounty on them to reduce the herd. I was there for 7 days and I saw three of them. They are proliferating like an unmanaged deer herd, and literally they are everywhere. Not only are they highly radioactive, but they're notoriously mean anyway. I was walking on a path in the woods taking samples, and there was a sign in Japanese, and I turned to my friend who was Japanese, and he said, "What does that mean?" And he says, "Warning, this is a wild boar path." So we very quickly decided it was time to move on from there. The farmer I showed you in that picture, this is his farm. He was told by the Japanese government that he needed to destroy his herd, and he refused. He said, "You know, my cows didn't cause this problem. Why should they be, my cattle," this was a cattle farm, "why should they be killed?" And he refused to slaughter the herd. So they're living a natural life on contaminated soil, and as they die, they die. This is me taking a tooth sample from the skull of one of the dead animals, and that's being analyzed in the lab. But I wanted to talk to you about this farmer, because this is another one of my heroes. First off, he stood up to the Japanese government and refused to destroy his herd. But the second thing he did is he took the manure, put it in a wheelbarrow, and walked to Tokyo, 120 miles away, and dumped it on the steps of Tokyo Electric. Now that's speaking truth to power. This was a children's playground that was in use. Kids are playing on this playground. And the reading on my radiation detector is 70 times higher than what we're getting right here today. So the background in that children's playground is 70 times higher than the background you and I are exposed to. The village elders are refusing to close the school. They realize that if they close the school, they lose the heart of the community because the kids won't be there. And they would rather sacrifice the kids or put the kids at risk than to fundamentally change the life in the village. This is the Fukushima worker's abandoned home. It was his dream house. It was on the end of a cul-de-sac with a gorgeous view of the mountains in the background. I think you can see in the haze. It is so contaminated, there's nothing they can do to clean it up. I went in with my radiation detector and it pegged the meter. I could not measure how high the radiation was at the side of his home. Now think about that. This was his dream house, and he built it just about 2 years before the disaster, and he will never, ever get to spend another night in it. This stadium is going to be used for the Olympic baseball games. It's a gorgeous stadium. It's in the middle of Fukushima Prefecture. And it's been placed, the choice of using this stadium as opposed to another stadium anywhere else in Japan is obviously to show the world that it's over. The disaster's over, you can come back in, and you can play ball. And it's a gross public relations ploy, risking athletes and the people who observed the events. These are clothes from a Fukushima Daiichi worker. Not somebody who was in the plant, but somebody who was working on the piles of the bag piles. And we have a complete set of his clothes, his socks, his boots, his gloves, his undergloves, his pants, his shirt, and the cross-hatching, the safety cross-hatching that he wore. When we analyzed it, we found out that it was highly radioactive. Now, these people are recruited for these jobs from throughout Japan, and they go home on weekends. And we found that the most highly radioactive piece of his clothing was his crotch. Mm-hmm. Think about that. So these guys are leaving the prefecture on a weekly basis to go home to their families. And you can't tell me that some of the contamination on the clothing does not get either imbibed or stuck to their skin as well. This is a scanning electron microscope. That thing in the background is a scanning electron microscope. It costs about $3 million. And you recall the picture at the very beginning was a scanning electron microscope photograph. So this was in a lab that had just been opened by the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency. And they showed Dr. Kaltofen and I their entire lab. And Dr. Kaltofen asked a great question. He said, you know, we've got our data out there, and you know, have you read our report? Which they hadn't. And he said, well, where is your data? This lab is as good as the work we're doing at Worcester Poly. And the director, who's over there on the left, said, oh, we take great data. We're just not publishing it. So they're not letting scientists know. They're not letting doctors know. And they're certainly not letting the professional literature know what we have found. They can do quality work and probably are doing quality work. They're just refusing to publish it. And anybody who's familiar with the scientific method here, you know, it works only when people share data. And when you refuse to share data, I think that says a lot about concerns beyond the data. To kind of summarize my experiences in Japan, I have become sort of a friend to Naoto Kan. Naoto Kan was the prime minister of Japan before Abe, and he was the person who was in charge during the period of that the disaster began. We all know when Fukushima ends and began and when Chernobyl end began, but there's no end on them. That, you know, we have a beginning, but they just go on forever. But Naoto Kan said to me, our existence as a sovereign nation was at stake. And I talked to him about the decision to evacuate Tokyo or not. And I said, you know, given the information he had, I think he made the right decision. And he said to me, he said, Arnie, the information I received, and this is from METI, the regulator, and from Tokyo Electric, said the information I received was neither accurate nor timely. Now, how can you regulate when your staff and Tokyo Electric are telling you lies, and when they tell you it, it's already old news? That's what Naoto Kan had to face. In addition, of course, if you read Gorbachev's memoirs, he credits the collapse of the Soviet Union, not the perestroika. Perestroika is the open government that the communist state was moving to. He said, we didn't fail because of perestroika. We failed because of Chernobyl. So nuclear is a technology that can destroy the fabric of a country overnight. And there's nothing like that on the planet. You know, if a coal plant blows up, it blows up. But when a nuclear plant blows up, it destroys the fabric of a country overnight. So my hats are off to the women of Japan for stepping up and taking the lead politically on this environmental issue. The numbers are about 80% of the women want nuclear closed down, and slightly less than half of the men want nuclear closed down. The net effect is 60 to 70% of the total population wants nuclear closed down. And yet the Abe administration continues to build, to start up these plants that have been deferred. And the reason for that is the pressure from the banks who want their money back. So to close now, let's talk about Dresden versus Chicago. The crow flight distance from Dresden to Chicago is 47 miles. Most of the data I took was beyond 47 miles from Fukushima. And in addition, Fukushima is contaminating the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific is 30,000 times bigger than all of the Great Lakes combined. So if a nuclear plant can contaminate the Pacific Ocean, think what it can do to the Great Lakes. Radiation knows no borders.
Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education. We'll have a link up to his website on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 344. Activist shout out! A reminder that on Sunday, March 11, the 7th anniversary of the start of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, there will be worldwide protests in front of Japanese embassies. On Monday, March 12, there will be a global boycott of all Japanese goods and services. No sushi restaurants on Monday. You're not still eating sushi, are you? Really? Huh. Another reminder that Atomic Homefront, that incredible documentary about the situation in North St. Louis with the illegally, irresponsibly buried nuclear waste, the health impact on the people who have grown up and still live in the subdivision that has grown up around this landfill, and the brave mothers who are fighting back against all the powers to see that the cleanup is done before further catastrophe takes place. Atomic Homefront will be on HBO on February 12th, and beyond that, in rotation. Be there. It's an incredible film. Here's today's final thought. Everyone, hold a good thought for me. I'm making this an official declaration. I am finishing my book. Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Fukushima to 3 Mile Island and beyond, is a nuclear memoir and a whole lot more. I've been promising it for a long time. There's even a sample chapter of it that's been up on my website if you sign up for the weekly email. But now I am aiming and intending and stating that I will have it published by the 3 Mile Island anniversary, March 28th of 2018, not some other year. This announcement to you is my accountability call, my feet to the fire, and my seat in the writing hot seat. Let's see how well I do. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 23rd, 2018. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2018, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, delivered with as much attitude as possible, please take a moment to send a donation to nuclearhotseat.com. Just go to our website. It's pretty self-evident once you get there. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that there is no such thing as a limited nuclear war. The effects are limitless and last forever on the one planet that we all share. There! You have all had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.